talk about a lot of subjects here on Issues, etc. I mean, we cover, it's amazing what we cover if you actually think about it. And I say that with no small amount of, gratitude toward everybody that makes it happen. But every year and a half or so, a subject comes along that's different. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. I can tell when we're on to something. I call it disproportional response. I'll tell you a little bit about what I mean in just a minute. But first, a lineup of what we're going to be talking about today here on Issues, Etc. The first hour is open lines for your questions and your comments. I have a few things to say. I'm going to open up the mailbag, by the way, and read, I would say, kind of the typical letter, anonymous, nasty letter we get. I've said it often on the air. The nastiest letters and emails I get are from Christians. The nicest one I ever received of someone who disagrees with me was from an atheist. He was cordial. He was polite. He didn't call me any names. Very clear that he disagreed with me on virtually everything. He even invited me to come out and speak to his atheist group. He was not threatened by the truth. Disproportional response. Now, a little bit later on the program, in the second hour, Chris Armstrong will be joining us from Christian History Magazine. He's managing editor there in Carroll Stream, Illinois. We're going to be talking with him about the early church fathers and how they read the Bible. It may surprise you to learn that Christians have read the Bible differently, not toward a different end, but differently in the history of the church. And the church fathers are a good study in the different ways that Christians have read the Bible. Some of them are more solid than others. How do we read the Bible in comparison to how the early church fathers did? We'll talk about that with Chris Armstrong. Then, in the second part of the second hour, we'll be talking with Pat Truman of the Family Research Council about TV profanity and the FCC. You heard about the recent ruling, the FCC's ruling on the F word, Bono the musician. A few flagrant adjectives tossed into some of his on-air verbiage during a recent awards ceremony brought a case before the FCC. The FCC said, unless you use that word to describe what it's intended to describe, if you only use it as an adjective, there's not a problem here. It's not obscene. It's not a problem. We'll talk with the Family Research Council about that. Then Douglas Gentile will join us to talk about video games and your kids. I like to play video games. I don't have as much time as I used to, but I like to play them. It's hard to find ones that are appropriate for kids. We'll be talking about the rating system. When you're going out for your Christmas presents for the grandkids and you look at these video games, you know they want it, and you see the rating system there on the box, and you say, I don't know what this means. What does T mean? What does E mean? What does M mean? When it says mature, does it mean a mature teenager? Does it mean it's got something in there that no kid should see? We'll talk about that. And then Dr. Gene Edward Veith joins us for the last half hour of the program. We'll be talking to him about Christian symbolism in the movie that opens today. Actually, it's the third in the trilogy, The Return of the King, the third in the Ring trilogy. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is culture editor for World Magazine. We'll be talking about the Christian worldview there in Tolkien's novels and the movies from which that have been made from them, and Christian symbolism in there as well. And we hope to talk sometime here during these three hours with someone about the FDA and the morning after pill. That's the lineup. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You sit behind a microphone long enough, you can learn a couple things. One, you learn that when people tell you that they never listen to you, especially when they're disagreeing with you, they're listening every day. They're the ones who can't help it. They're constantly going back and forth trying to see what you're saying. You learn that very quickly. It's the people who say they don't listen to you who can tell you exactly what you said. How they do that without listening, I do not know. But another thing you'll learn is that you're going to get nasty responses from the audience on a regular basis. You can't say anything. I could say today is December the 18th. Oh, I'm sorry, it's the 17th. It's a Wednesday, and I'm sitting here in St. Louis. someone out there is going to disagree with me. I'm sorry. It's going to happen. You can talk about the weather. You can talk about anything and people will disagree. You learn that. Another thing you learn is when you're onto something. I call it disproportional response. You could call it passion if you want to. You'll get a response. And you know when you're onto a subject that isn't just a subject by itself, but it's a tip of an iceberg. It's the first, it's one sacred cow in a whole herd of sacred cows that when you poke it, all the other cows in the herd start mooing. And you realize you're onto something. I thought we were just going to be talking about this little thing. And the next thing you know, disproportional response. Passion on both sides. From the callers, from those who email you or write you, positive or negative, they're passionate about it. That's how you know when you're onto something. Promise keepers. That was one of them. Prayer of Jabez. Remember that one? Bet you that book's gathering dust someplace. Still reading it faithfully, saying your prayer every day? I doubt it. Purpose-driven life, most recently. We've heard from people in Illinois, Missouri, Wisconsin, Texas, Arizona, Vancouver, Wyoming. That's just the ones I could dig up before the show. Positive and negative, disproportional response. Now, here's an example. Let me see if I can find this here. There we go. Here's an example. Opening up the mailbag. I received this recently. Actually, I didn't read it until last night because kind of in typical fashion, I don't read my mail until it's old. Good thing my paychecks go in by direct deposit, otherwise I'd never have any money. An anonymous note from a listener. I get a lot of anonymous mail. There's one guy who's been writing me anonymously, literally writing me, with the old-fashioned typewriter for 5 years. Has never signed his name, never put a return address. And sometimes it's a little frustrating, I'll be honest with you, because I consider that to be kind of the crank call of the postal system. There's not a lot you can do about it. You can't respond. They haven't given you an opportunity to. Because the purpose of an anonymous note is not to engage in any kind of conversation. It's just to fire a shot. It's the drive-by shooting of the postal world sometimes, if it's nasty enough. I'll just give you my personal opinion on this, and that is, what courage of my convictions I do have, at least I have enough to come on the air and give you my real name. And to stand behind what I say. And I expect to be corrected when I'm wrong. But I'd like to know who's correcting me. So at least we could have a conversation. Here's one that's, I'll just say this is typical. Reverend Wilkin, and when you listen to this, don't get all worked up, okay? Because I'll be quite honest with you, you get enough of this every day, and you just can't get worked up anymore. I heard your guest appearance last Thursday on another program here on the radio station. It was accidental, since I don't listen to your program because of the negativity. But accidental or not, I heard you again, and I have to respond anonymously. After hearing some of your comments about Pharisees, I was talking with someone about Pharisees. I have to ask the question, do you listen to yourself? You and your regular buddies, and he mentions here a few of our guests, which is an odd thing since he says he doesn't listen, but go figure. You and your regular guests are modern-day Pharisees. You criticize any non-traditional, by your judgment, church movement, Promise Keepers, Willow Creek, church growth, and lately, the purpose-driven book and author. That's why this letter is anonymous. I don't want to be the next person you or movement you attack. Actually, I'm hoping you run out of topics and sponsors and they replace you with music. Seriously, for the sake of Christ Church, turn from your contentious agitation within the church to be a positive force for the Holy Spirit to use to change lives. The spirit and intent of God's word is what Christ was all about, but you Pharisees just don't get it then or now. Signed, a lifelong member of my church body. Now, I did not read the entire thing because there are people mentioned there that don't need to be mentioned on the air. Now, laying aside the fact that by this listener's definition, the person who has written me is just as guilty of the very thing they've accused me of. That is, they don't like me criticizing what I consider to be wrong in the church. They feel free to write and criticize me anonymously. Laying that aside, it does raise one thing. It's not the first time I've been called a Pharisee, and I know that that's easy. You know what I like to liken it to? Remember when O.J. Simpson was on trial? And they tried everything that they could to mount a defense of this guy. I mean, what do? You got blood in the car, blood in the house, bloody gloves. I mean, what do when you mount a defense? He did get off, by the way, if you remember correctly. You got a low-speed car chase. No other suspects. Motive, opportunity, means. When everything else ran out and it had turned into a media circus, do you remember, and this is where we first heard this term, the card that was played. They call it now, and you've heard the term too, the race card. Michael Jackson's lawyers didn't even wait until a trial to pull this one out. The afternoon he was arrested and booked for molesting children, they decided they were going to play the race card. And everyone said, look, they're playing the race card. It's very obvious. They're basically putting forth an argument that either O.J. or Michael Jackson, or whoever it is, if he weren't a prominent black man, then they wouldn't be making this big deal out of it, and it's all because he's black. This is a ploy designed to stifle all arguments. Fortunately, the race card is not a legal argument. Therefore, it's one you play in the media and not in the courtroom. At least you shouldn't be playing it in the courtroom. Well, Christians have their own race card. I call it the Pharisee card. It's the card that's played that is intended to silence all criticism of whatever it is you want to defend. If you criticize X, you're a Pharisee. Because after all, you know those nasty Pharisees dressed in black, twisting their black mustaches. You know those nasty Pharisees, they criticize Jesus. Therefore, anyone who criticizes, period, anything, points out that something's wrong, anything, period, can be labeled a Pharisee. It's like the race card. It's the Pharisee card. So today in the church, anyone who zealously defends the truth, which means also they're going to expose error, is liable to be called a Pharisee. You can pretty much expect it. The first time I was called a Pharisee, I was taken aback because, you know, I had only been doing this radio thing for a little while, and I had come from a situation, a parish where, you know, I just didn't get called names. I got along with my people. I didn't get in trouble for pointing out that something was wrong or teaching the truth. But then radio is a different thing. So the first time I was called a Pharisee, it was a little surprising. Now, it's virtually a weekly occurrence, and I actually wear it, as long as someone's calling me a Pharisee because they think that, you know, anyone who criticizes anything or points out what's wrong is a Pharisee, as long as that's why they're calling me a Pharisee, I'll wear that as a badge of honor. If that's what it means to be a Pharisee, I'll happily do that. But who wants to be called a Pharisee? Nobody. Actually, it's a specious accusation, if you think about it. The Pharisees were not defenders of truth. They were false teachers. And if anyone took after anyone, it was Jesus taking after the Pharisees. Read the Gospels. Who starts the fight? It's not the Pharisees. Jesus, by word and deed, instigates their opposition. And he doesn't do it because he wants to pick a fight. He doesn't do it because he just likes an argument. He does it because he's preaching the truth. You can't preach the truth without error getting exposed. And in Jesus' day, it was the error of the Pharisees. In fact, those who defend the truth and thereby expose error, we're just doing our little part here on this little radio program. They are simply following Jesus' example. It's Jesus who first utters the words, "Beware of false prophets." It is Jesus who tells us that false prophets are not always obvious. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. It is Jesus who says, "You will know them by their fruits." Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles. Even so, every good tree bears good fruit. Bad trees bear bad fruit. A good tree can't produce bad fruit, and a bad tree can't produce good fruit. What's he saying? There is the good fruit of the truth. That's how you tell you've got a good tree and a prophet on your hands. And then there's the bad fruit of error. And that's how you tell you've got a false prophet on your hands. By their fruit, you will know them. Now, did Jesus fault the Pharisees of his day because they were too zealously defending the truth? You know, this is one of the kind of sidelines of the whole Pharisee card, and that is, well, you know, what makes a Pharisee is someone who has the truth but is nitpicky about the truth. They nitpick. Does Jesus fault the Pharisees because they're too zealously defending the truth? They're too overly concerned with the truth? No. He faulted them for abandoning the truth of God's word in favor of the word of man. Did Jesus fault the Pharisees because they opposed false teaching? No, he faulted them because they were false teachers. They were the very false teachers that Jesus was warning his disciples against. Beware the leaven of the Pharisees. And they're looking at each other saying, what is he talking about? Bread? Did we forget to bring bread? Finally, they realize he's talking about the teachings of the Pharisees. Jesus did not condemn the Pharisees because they defended the truth. He condemned them because they defended error. Starting to see the picture here? The error of the Pharisees was not their opposition to false teaching. It was their opposition to the truth. Now, by contrast, now listen carefully, by contrast with those who play the Pharisee card today, who whenever they hear something criticized, one of their sacred cows gets poked, the tip of their iceberg, someone lands on it and realizes that they're onto something. By contrast with those who play the Pharisee card today, what does Jesus call those who zealously defend the truth and thereby expose errors? What does he call them? He calls them disciples. If you abide in my word, then you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Nothing to fear from the truth, even when it exposes errors. That's what it's intended to do. The first thing that truth always does, like a light shining in a dark room, shines into the dark corners and shows us what's there. What's there that shouldn't be there. Now, there are those who say that, and this is one that I've puzzled over for a long time, there are those who say that you can't, how does it go here? The truth doesn't need a defense, only exposure, something like that. Try living that way just a single day. I'll challenge you with, for those of you who say, the truth doesn't need a defense, just exposure. Don't criticize what's wrong, only say what's right. Don't tell me what we shouldn't believe, tell me what we should believe. As though the two could be divorced from one another. Try living that way for just one day. In fact, you don't even have to do it for 24 hours. Tomorrow when you wake up until tomorrow when you go to bed. Try it. Try living by the philosophy that the truth needs no defense. You know, people who say this don't live this way either. They don't. What they believe to be true and worth defending, they defend. Which tells you something about some people who say the truth doesn't need a defense. maybe what they're really saying is they don't think the truth is worth defending, because there are things that they will defend as true on a daily basis. Can you teach your children what they should do without at the same time teaching them what they shouldn't do? We're going to be talking about video games. Can you show them what they shouldn't be enjoying in terms of a video game without, or can you show them what they should be enjoying without warning them against what they shouldn't be? Your daughter comes home and she's got some guy with her. And it's obvious to you that he's not the kind of guy you want your daughter dating. You sit down and have a talk with your daughter. It's going to be very difficult for you to explain to your daughter the kind of guy she should be going out with without pointing out the kind of guy she shouldn't be going out with. Right? Every time we set limits for our kids, we're warning them against error. Every time we teach them the truth, we have to. It's necessary to expose error. So just try living that way for a single day. When the guy cuts you off in traffic, don't say they shouldn't have done that, because that would be pointing out that someone is doing something wrong. Just go about your business and do what you should do. If that guy later decides to break into your house, well, you're up a creek. What kind of radio show would Issues Etc. be if we programmed according to the philosophy that the truth needs no defense? Wesley Smith, he'd have to go. Any guest from National Right to Life, they'd have to go too, because, of course, when they're on, they talk about an error. And they point it out in great detail. Abortion, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research. We could have no guests on Islam. Because, of course, that would require that we actually talk about where Islam is wrong, and that would leave out the Mormons, too, and the Jehovah's Witnesses. And we certainly couldn't talk about the two things we're going to talk about later today. We certainly could not talk about violent video games. We should only talk about the fun ones, the sunshine and flower video games. We couldn't talk about the F-word ruling of the FCC, because we wouldn't want to point out that the FCC was wrong to allow that on the airwaves. You see, you cannot advocate for the truth without at the same time pointing out error. Or let's just put it in terms that everyone can understand. You, the listeners to this program, we would not be able to allow you to call and disagree. We couldn't. If we programmed the show according to the belief that the truth needs no defense, we couldn't take calls that disagree, which we do on a regular basis. You see, the truth needs no defense, not from me, nor from you, the listener. When we come back, if you haven't gotten it already, the truth doesn't exist in isolation from error.
Truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you think Christian parents should avoid the subject of Santa Claus with their children? Did you know that the real St. Nicholas was a 4th century pastor? But did he really live at the North Pole and distribute gifts on Christmas Eve? How do we separate fact from fiction? Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House recommend the new children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on St. Nicholas by Julie Stiegemeyer. The book contains museum-quality artwork with family-friendly language. Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040. St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on Hindus and lets you learn one of their basic beliefs. You've heard the term karma. Hindus believe karma is based on a system of cause and effect. According to this doctrine, God isn't responsible for the pleasure or pain of his creatures. they suffer or enjoy based on their own bad or good deeds. Hindus also believe that karma from past lives can be stored up, and that this is a spiritual law which doesn't change based upon a person's success or failure. A teaching on the website hindunet.org concludes that the best thing is not to change the world or improve as individuals, but to rest peacefully with what exists. Pray that Hindus will hear that Christ's sacrifice and resurrection fulfill all the laws that he's established. Get prayer news from around the world by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. 100 years since the first flight by the Wright brothers. Wow! For me, the greatest flight of all time, one not mentioned this week, is the ascension of Jesus Christ. After his death and resurrection, Jesus was taken up before his disciples' very eyes, and a cloud hid him from their sight. Acts 1:9. Honestly, it does sound like a pious myth. Jesus was taken into heaven, which refers to the unseen world, the visible and the invisible. You and I live in the visible world, but God dwells in light inaccessible. The cloud that hid Jesus was the same divine cloud that had led Israel through its desert wanderings. It was God receiving the man from Nazareth, his only begotten Son, into the unseen glory to which his Spirit draws us still today. I have no uncontestable proof that the body of Christ lifted off earth and ascended to that cloud. To believe that happened is not based upon scientific proof, but on faith in God's revelation. Can the God who made birds to fly, who lifted the prophet Elijah to heaven, 2 Kings 2:11, raise a man from earth to heaven? I'm trusting he can, because that's a flight I want to take.
Well, the triumphal entry has happened, and Jesus is now in Jerusalem. He has less than a week to live, and he is being confronted by his opponents. Let's talk about that in the context of Luke chapter 20 next time on the Bible Study with Pastor Ed Wolfe of St. James Lutheran Church in Glen Carbon. Listen to the Bible Study weekday mornings at 10:05. Luke 20 next time.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking a bit about what I'm calling the Pharisee card. It's a little bit like the race card. You can shut down all discussion. You can basically stifle all criticism by playing the Pharisee card. It's very easy. I've seen it played many times. Now, actually, the occasion for this is a recent kind of a typical letter that I read a little bit earlier, in which I am accused, along with my guest, of being a Pharisee because I criticize things that I find to be wrong or in error in the church. This goes to the very heart of what we're doing here on this program. It does. As I was saying before, if you program a radio program that never points out any problems, never criticizes error, you won't have truth either. I mentioned before, you know when you're onto something, when you get this disproportionate response, it's a little bit like a virus. A virus. These fads in the church. Be it the prayer of Jabez or promise keepers or the purpose-driven life. Viruses. Think about this. We got a church with no immune system. Or at least you would think we have a church with no immune system. Through promiscuous spiritual behavior. Theological promiscuity. I'll just call it what it is. Be it theological promiscuity akin to sexual promiscuity, or, you know, another way that you catch a virus, the kind of virus I'm talking about is intravenous drug use. A church that's mainlined false teaching straight to its people, right into the vein. You know, you live this way sexually and you will get a virus. If the church lives this way spiritually and theologically, so will the church. It has contracted the spiritual equivalent of HIV/AIDS, and its immune system is shot. This virus, eventually, if you let it have its way in the church, will make the church, what? Unable to fight any virus. And like so many who have AIDS, you know, we've talked about them before, people who have AIDS and say, hey, look, I still look healthy. The church is looking at itself saying, we still look healthy, but it has no immune system. People who have AIDS and have gotten it through their sexual promiscuity and think they can live with it, continue in their promiscuity. A church that has forfeited and abandoned its immune system through theological promiscuity and mainlining false teaching, yet still thinks it's healthy, has no reason to stop it, does it? Let's go to the phones. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. I'm not certain, but I believe the word truth, you probably know better than I do in Greek, that Christ used, I am the truth. Isn't the word truth by nature singular? That there can be nothing other than truth, and no other truths can be called other truths?
Well, yes, you're right, and that's not so much a principle of Scripture, Bill, as it is a principle of logic. If something is true, then things that are contradictory to that truth are of necessity false. Now,
right.
Try making that case in the average congregation. Good luck, because most of us have been brainwashed into thinking that, well, things that are contrary to the truth can also be true.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense, but that's the way we think.
That's called a cognitive dissonance.
It's called insanity, is what it's called.
Yes.
Yeah.
But truth. But anyway, with truth comes the responsibility of being responsible for that truth. I think that it is truth, and there is no other truth than to defend that truth.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate the call. Now we were talking about this before. It's very popular. It really appeals to our postmodern sense of tolerance to say things like, the truth needs no defense. It appeals to our postmodern sense of tolerance. Everyone has his own truth, and we, like Rodney King, we just all get along. But it's impossible. The truth always exposes error. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, whether you want it to or not. Back to the phones. Ann is calling from St. Louis. Ann, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I don't even know how to word this question, so please be patient with me. I wanted to ask you, you're talking about the truth, and your program really does always hit the nail right on the head. And I so much appreciate that. I want to know what truth does the Missouri does the Lutheran Missouri Synod, what truths are, I don't know, here, okay. What truth does the Lutheran Missouri Synod Church defend that the Roman Catholic Church doesn't defend? And vice versa. I mean, in other words, what I'm asking is, where is the truth?
Anne, thank you very much. It's a good question. Where is the truth? You know, think about it. Before I answer a question, think about this for a moment. What are some of the popular ways of answering that question? She's given us a basic, what are the differences between Roman Catholics and Lutherans? Where does the truth lie? With them? With us, with us, with them? The popular way of answering that, if I just wanted to get off the hook and give the typical answer that you might hear in any church is, well, Anne, as with all things, the truth lies somewhere between. We have our truth and you have your truth, and no one's truth is absolute. Although our truths seem to be in contradiction, the truth, in fact, lies somewhere between us. I don't have it. You don't have it. No one has it. but it's out there someplace, wherever it may be. And a lot of people hear that answer and they say, ooh, that sounds great, yeah. Because it means we don't have to worry about the truth anymore. We can all happily go our merry way and get along with one another, and as long as we don't talk about anything that we might disagree about, as long as we limit our conversations to things where we wouldn't disagree, we're doing great. Very limited conversations indeed. Now, in answer to your question, Anne, it is my contention that we share a great amount of truth, but we also disagree on a great number of things. Very important things. First and foremost is how it is someone is declared righteous, or whether or not someone is declared righteous before God by grace through faith for the sake of Christ. I'm not talking about what Catholics believe as opposed to what Lutherans believe. I'm talking about the teachings of the respective churches. In spite of all the efforts of late to try and say we don't disagree on this, we still do. It's in black and white. You can get individual Lutherans and individual Catholics to agree on this subject, but they have to fall on one side or the other. They either have to agree with the Catholic teaching or agree with the Lutheran teaching on this, because they're different. And flowing out from that basic fundamental difference are all the other differences between Lutherans and Catholics. Now, you might ask, do we agree more than we disagree? I guess if you went through a book and highlighted pages on what we agree or disagree, you could say we agree on far more than we disagree. But the things that we disagree, it's not sheer volume of things that we agree about. If all we disagreed about was whether or not God declares sinners righteous by grace alone, through faith alone, for the sake of Christ alone, if that was all we disagreed about, and by the way, just as a footnote, it's impossible to only disagree about that. If that was all we disagreed about, it would still be enough to say we have a profound disagreement on our hands. I've said this before. Some of you may not have heard me say it. This is the lost art of modern Christendom, the ability to disagree. The ability to disagree without calling one another the devil or Pharisees or any other name. The ability to disagree and be honest about it. Christians of ages past had no problem disagreeing with one another. They expected to disagree with one another. They always believed that they were better off in an honest disagreement than in a dishonest agreement. Christians of today, I'm not so sure. I think Christians of today might be happier with a dishonest agreement than an honest disagreement. Here's the basic question. Is the truth worth defending? You're the Roman Catholic, I'm the Lutheran. Is what you believe worth defending? Or are you going to just surrender? You're the Baptist, I'm the Lutheran. You're the Charismatic, I'm the Lutheran. Whatever it may be. Is the truth worth defending? When I hear someone say the truth needs no defense, what I hear is actually an unwillingness to defend against error. If this is true, then things other than this are false. And the truth never exists in isolation from its counterpart, error. In order to say that the truth needs no defense, you either have to believe that it's not worth defending. I mean, it's just not that big of a deal after all. Or you have to believe that error is harmless, innocuous, and won't do anyone any harm. You know, we're going to be talking a little bit later about harmful video games for your kids. That if they play these video games, it will rot their brains, or it will misalign them socially, or make them more likely to be violent or to think violently or to act violently. And people will listen to that hour and say, I'm glad they talked about that on Issues, etc., because that's the kind of thing that's dangerous to our kids Here's a little secret, folks. False teaching is far more dangerous than violent video games. They're both dangerous, but false teaching is far more dangerous. A violent video game can just mess you up for this life. It can screw you up for this life. False teaching can wind you up in hell. It's dangerous. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And Jesus says of the Pharisees, the real Pharisees, not what we call Pharisees today, those false teachers, beware the leaven of the Pharisees. He didn't say, oh, you know those false teachers, the Pharisees? Aren't they cute? Aren't they just adorable? Oh, what they teach? Don't worry about that. That's not going to hurt you. No. He says, beware. Beware the teaching of the Pharisees, these false teachers of Jesus' day. We're going to spend the remainder of this hour talking about a decision by an advisory group for the Food and Drug Administration to ease restrictions on what's being called euphemistically the morning after pill. The brand name in some states where it's already being sold over the counter without age restrictions, Plan B. Judy Brown, president and founder of the American Life League based in Stafford, Virginia, is our guest. Judy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's a pleasure.
What in the world has been decided here about the morning after pill?
Well, by a vote of 21-4, the commissioners that had been appointed by the FDA to study this question decided that they would recommend to the Food and Drug Administration that Plan B, morning after what we call abortion pills, will be made available, should be made available over the counter, which means that they would be for sale in any drugstore in the United States in the same way that Band-Aids and aspirin are.
Now, what has to happen in terms of the FDA's procedure and protocol for that actually to be a reality?
The Food and Drug Administration now has to study this recommendation, and they have already announced that at the end of February 2004, they will make their decision. Historically, when a commission appointed by the FDA makes a recommendation such as the one that was made yesterday, the Food and Drug Administration will concur in that recommendation and actually make a formal decision. So it is possible that at the end of February, the Food and Drug Administration could release any requirement for prescription status for the Plan B morning after pill and make it available over the counter in every pharmacy in the United States.
I heard on the news this morning it was being discussed, and someone said, no, this isn't an abortion pill. This isn't RU486. This is, quote unquote, emergency contraception. But you just a few minutes ago did refer to it as an abortion pill. Tell us
about
that.
Well, Todd, it is an abortion. I mean, first of all, and I explained this to the commissioners very carefully yesterday, we are dealing with two scientific realities. Number one, when a human egg and a human sperm unite at conception, there is a new human being with identifiable DNA. At that moment, at conception, there is a human being, a person there, and the mother is a mother. She becomes a mother at that point. Therefore, secondly, pregnancy begins at conception, when the baby begins. Now, the Food and Drug Administration has changed their definition of pregnancy, and they now say that pregnancy doesn't begin until the baby implants herself in her mother's womb, which is a good 7 to 8 days after conception. So they are able to say with a straight face, even though they're lying through their teeth, that these pills do not abort children. But scientifically and realistically, and anybody who's ever had a baby can tell you, there's an abortion going on. A baby is a baby at conception, not at some other point when the Food and Drug Administration says so.
Tell us about the pill itself. I take it is essentially a massive dose of female hormones. Am
That's
I right?
Absolutely correct. This particular regimen, which is called Plan B, is levonorgestrel, which is one artificially produced hormone. Normally, in a birth control pill, there will be approximately 0.40 milligrams in a birth control pill of levonorgestrel. By the time you take both of the pills in Plan B, you've taken 1.5. So you've taken a massive dose of this artificial hormone and ingested it into your body. Now, there are side effects that many of the doctors yesterday during the testimony brought to the attention of these commissioners: blood clots, ectopic pregnancy, heart problems. And still, with this fact before them, they voted the way they did. You know, it's long been practice, medical practice, that before any woman could get these pills, just the regular dose, I'm not talking about megadose, a complete family history had to be acquired so that women who already had some kind of a problem in the family that would indicate they could suffer a deadly side effect from the pill would not be given a prescription for the pill. But now, all of a sudden, a megadose of these very same pills is going to be made available, I hope it's not, but it looks like it will be, over the counter to people of all ages, by the way. These pills will not be restricted to adults.
On that issue, has the FDA overseen any research testing these pills on children?
No, Todd. I listened to every single result of every single clinical study that they presented yesterday, and there was only one study out of the seven that were presented that involved anybody between the ages of 15 and 18, and out of several hundred women, 30 of them happened to be teenagers. So the fact of the matter is there have been no studies done on how these artificial chemicals respond and react in the body of a developing girl. None.
Why this vote? Why an overwhelming vote for this when, as you point out, not only were they informed of better knowledge, but they should know better?
You know, I think that I have to be very honest, even though it sounds cruel, and say that there is a growing attitude in the medical profession, as well as in politics, that women's rights supersede the value and dignity of any other human being, especially the most vulnerable of all human beings, the person who resides in his or her mother's womb. And the reason this decision was made is political. The vast majority of people at the FDA, the advisors as well as those who sit in positions of authority at the FDA, have been there for years. And they have been the strongest proponents of RU486, the strongest proponents of these pills, the strongest proponents of any kind of abortion, because they honestly believe that a woman has a right to decide whether or not she, quote-unquote, wants to be pregnant, and if she doesn't, she should have the ability, and she has the right, they say, to eliminate this child. They don't look at that as a child. They look at it as a question of whether or not this woman has a right to exercise her rights. And so, frankly, I think they are blinded by political power, and they are not any longer interested in the truth.
The FDA is, of course, a regulatory agency, and if I'm not mistaken, at the very least, the head of the FDA serves at the pleasure of the president.
Yes.
Can President George W. Bush, he seems to be strongly leaning toward the pro-life side, can he do anything about this?
Absolutely, he can do something about this. And in fact, we're mounting a petition campaign to the president's attention. We want him to order the Food and Drug Administration to suspend any decision on the provision of these pills over the counter until such time as a complete and thorough investigation of the ties that the individual commissioners might have to this entire industry are made public and investigated, because we've got to get the president, who claims he's pro-life, to stop this before it's too late. My fear is that too many teenage girls are going to suffer awful consequences, not to mention the number of children who are going to die in the womb, and then it will be too late. We will have lost lives. And I think the president has a moral obligation to intervene here because he is pro-life.
Other than seeking the president's action here, mm-hmm. What else can our listeners do?
Oh, well, contacting your elected members of Congress immediately, the House and the Senate, and letting them know that the Food and Drug Administration absolutely cannot be permitted to approve this drug for over-the-counter status, and asking them to pass an emergency law, if necessary, to suspend this approval process until a complete investigation can be done. The Congress can do this. The Congress has the authority to do this. The question is, do they have the will to do this?
Worst-case scenario, the FDA goes ahead and approves this. No mm-hmm. one who has responsibility for such things does anything about it. Should we expect then that Plan B, the morning-after pill, this abortion pill, will be marketed aggressively to young people?
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. We will file a lawsuit immediately, of course. We did that the last time in 1999 when the FDA actually approved the drug. And the problem then in 1999 was that we couldn't find people who would come forward as plaintiffs and claim that they had been misled, because there's a level of embarrassment and anxiety and a whole bunch of stuff. But we're going to try it again, because now people have had 4 years to suffer through the experiences with these pills, and I think it will be easier for us to find the right plaintiffs so that the case has standing in a court of law, which is exactly what we need. You can't just sue. You have to have standing.
So what other states are there that actually have allowed this to be sold over the counter?
Well, among them, the state of Washington and the state of California, and I understand there are a couple of others which I am not familiar with.
So, in other words, you now have the possibility of actually seeking out people who might have grievances.
Yes.
Who have used this pill, who can be plaintiffs in lawsuits.
Exactly. And I'm hoping that that's exactly what happens. I mean, the best case scenario would be that the FDA says, no, we don't have enough evidence. And, you know, that's perhaps the most frightening thing about what happened during the hearing yesterday. It became very clear from the questions that were asked of the researchers that the people who were sitting on that panel knew there wasn't enough evidence upon which to make a proper decision. They even said so. And yet they turned around and recommended it anyway. And I just find that mind-boggling.
Very, very quickly, with only 30 seconds, is this essentially the same FDA that several years ago fast-tracked RU486?
Oh, of course it is. It absolutely is. Those bureaucrats don't go away just because the presidents change.
Oh, my goodness. Maybe they should. Thank you very much, Judy Brown. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, and God bless.
Judy Brown, president and founder of the American Life League, based in Stafford, Virginia. If you would like to contact them, you can do that either by going on the web at all.org, all.org, or you can contact them toll-free, 1-888-546-2580. That's 546-2580. It's the American Life League. And I would encourage you, in the seconds left here, to do precisely what Judy Brown suggests. First of all, if there is a petition someplace that could be sent to the president, that he should do something about this and order the FDA to halt any decision, sign it. Contact your congressman and your senators. Let them know that this is a bad decision on the part of the Food and Drug Administration, that your children and your grandchildren, your granddaughters and sons, should not have access to the morning after pill. When we come back from this break, we'll spend a half hour talking with Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine. How did the early church fathers read the Bible? How did they interpret it? We'll answer that question when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.